Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. Support the show and get your Everyone Loves Guitar t-shirts, hoodies, and mugs at guitarmerch.com, where you'll also find other cool music and guitar t-shirts. That's guitarmerch.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We got a kick-ass rock and roll star with us with Brian Quinn, the co-lead guitarist for Candlebox. And before we move forward, I just want to give a shout-out to Denise Kovalevich and Kevin Holland for making this happen. Thanks, guys. Brian's traveled the world. As I said, he's a co-lead guitarist for the multi-platinum rock band Candlebox. He's traveled the world performing in front of crowds as large as 90,000 at a time, and he shared the stage with some of the most iconic legends in the industry. Started playing guitar at 5. At 15, he was playing sold-out shows with his hardcore band, Burial Ground. He left after 6 years to move to Philadelphia in search of something more. Soon after that, he co-founded the Philadelphia-based rock band Octane, and still considered to this day one of the most successful bands to come out of Philly. Octane sold more than 65,000 copies of their independent debut release. Dude, that is really freaking cool.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's a crazy time.
And for you millennials, when sold more than 60, that means like people used to buy actual records. During this time, Brian was named best guitarist in the Philadelphia region by the Philadelphia Music Awards in 2001 and 2004. After 5 successful years with Octane, Brian left the band to form a blues-based hard rock band that would later become known as Foster Child, and they gained national attention and were signed to a major label from 2007 to 2010. The band hit the road on a U.S. tour, and Brian met Kevin Martin, the lead singer of Candlebox at that time. Those guys had some good chemistry, and Kevin promised him one day there'd be a spot for him in Candlebox, and here you are. He continued touring the country with Foster Child, and he even garnered a special invitation to perform for the U.S. troops stationed at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where the group performed in front of thousands of soldiers on New Year's Eve of 2010. How was that, man? I've heard people say that's like so rewarding doing that stuff.
It was. It was amazing. And I'll tell you, Cuba itself was absolutely beautiful.
Really?
Yeah, like untouched, really, where we were in there. But just getting to go down there and play for the troops and, you know, try to give something back to them for all the time and their duty that they sacrificed, man. It was really special for us to be down there. A close friend of mine was a lieutenant commander in the Navy. He does all the mental health for soldiers coming back from service, from war. And yeah, he was down there and we got the invite and, you know, met the major of the Marines. They took us all around the base. We got to have dinner with the admiral of the Navy, which was pretty amazing.
That is cool, man.
Yeah, it was a great trip. What an experience.
That's great, man. And I seriously, in all earnest, I do want to salute anybody that served. I really appreciate that, man. So thank you. Yeah. Where are we at here? Sorry about that. I'm spacing out. Recently, Brian was invited to perform at NAMM's Ultimate Jam Night alongside Steve Vai, who we had on the show, Billy Sheehan, who's coming on in a few weeks, and many other iconic artists. A proficient studio musician as well, Brian provided the critically acclaimed guitar work on Candlebox's latest album called Disappearing in Airports, excuse me, which debuted at number 9 on the Billboard charts, as well as Disappearing Live, which was released in 2017. There are a new album in the works, which will be out later this year, I'm hoping. And in addition, Brian's lent his guitar skills to a myriad of artists across multiple genres of music and studio. Dude, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Be here, Greg. Thanks for having me.
So you were in Burial Ground when really you were just a kid. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I was curious, what was like the good and the not so good lessons that you learned during that time? And were there any coping skills that you wish you had, but just due to your age, just were not available to you?
Well, at that time, being that age, you really don't, I really didn't care. I just wanted to play.
Yeah.
And the hardcore scene was very big. I grew up in the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area, and the hardcore scene there was pretty big because we were so close to the New York hardcore scene. And yeah, as far as the good that came from it, man, I just got a lot of mileage out of it as far as, you know, getting to shows, like, you know, just the little stuff, like when to load in, when not to load in, just getting the stage experience too at that age. You know, it was real high energy type music and heavy music. And, you know, we played a lot of really ratty clubs and church basements and fire halls was a big thing. So, you know, because we couldn't get into the bars, obviously, were the bars that would they do like afternoon matinee stuff and whatnot. So it was just a great experience. And then, I mean, the bad of it was you just got ripped off at every turn. You never made a penny doing it.
Oh, so really? Because of your age or just because?
We were kids and just didn't know better. So, you know, it's like I always talk about having a career in music and people talk to me about it. I said a lot of it is just learning what not to do.
Yeah.
And you just learn from your mistakes as you go on.
Did that help you like as you moved up the food chain, like that sense of awareness of, hey, let me look after the money? Because a lot of musicians are not just business minded.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. And even past that, just looking, I was always really interested in entertainment law. So just really educating myself on royalties and publishing and songwriting and this cut and that cut. And, you know, just, so I've been lucky enough that early on in my career, not long after Burial Ground, I met a very good entertainment lawyer that kind of walked me through a lot of stuff when I was younger, and then moved on to a different entertainment lawyer later on in my years, who kind of even taught me a little bit more.
That's great.
I've always been a sponge, especially with guitar, but also the business end of it, just listening and surrounding myself by people who know more than me, you know, because I always want to know, like, why does that guy know how to do this? And I want to know how to do it. You know?
That's great. Yeah. One of the, like, sometimes I ask a question, anything you wish you did different? And one of the most common answers, I wish I would have gotten schooled in business earlier. So Kudos to you for doing that, man. In your bio, it said you left Burial Ground to move to Philly in search of something more. What were you looking for, and why'd you pick Philly?
So Philly was the closest big city to the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area. And at that time, like, no bands were really getting picked up out of Scranton. And Philly was still pretty hot at that point in the like early to mid 90s. So I had applied for college and got accepted to Westchester University in their classical guitar program.
Oh, wow.
So I moved down here. I basically moved down here and never went home. I just fell in love with Philadelphia, and I fell in love with Westchester especially, and spent 2 years in the guitar program there. And it really wasn't exactly what I was looking for, just because I wanted to be in a band and
You went from hardcore to classical. I'm like processing that. I'm like, wow, that's pretty open. I got to give you credit though. That's really open-minded on your part to be even willing to do that.
As far as musically, and especially with guitar, I've always had a pretty broad stroke as far as what I like. I like everything from classical to up to Cannibal Corpse and Slayer, you know what I mean? So, and everything in between. I have a really broad taste in music and listening. I just, if it's good and I dig it, I'll listen. Yeah. The genre never really mattered to me.
That's very cool. So you said you stayed in school for a couple of years?
So I moved into the teaching program at Westchester. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in secondary education for history. And then right out of college, I just ended up, I took a job at, I ended up doing a couple shows in front of Government Mule back then.
Oh, wow.
So that was,
back when Alan Woody was probably still around. Wow. Yeah. Man, they've always been so I love them. I'm a huge fan. I have so many old bootlegs of theirs. They've always been just such a great band, haven't they?
Yeah, they're amazing, and they were such nice guys. And I was always interested in slide guitar. My friend James Callahan, who owned a couple clubs up in the Wilkes-Barre area, always gave us places to play when we were kids, and still to this day, a dear friend of mine. He knew Warren's manager at the time, who I believe Warren's married to now, Stephanie Scamardi. Stephanie Scamardo. So he said, hey man, do you want to go meet Warren? He's playing the show. So I was under 21, in fact, and he brought me to a show to meet him. And we got to talking. That was basically my introduction to slide guitar. He moved his room to an adjoining room of ours, and I got to spend a little bit of time with him over a couple of days, and was like, hey man, you do this, you don't do that. And that was kind of my education on how to play slide guitar.
That's so cool. You got private lessons from Warren Haynes. That is that's pretty freaking cool.
And it was quick, man. It was a quick thing too. We didn't get a whole lot of time together, But it was just that time was very it meant a lot to me. And he was my favorite player at the time, one of my favorite players at the time. I was following the Allman Brothers. Once I heard him playing slide, I just followed the Allman Brothers and saw them dozens of times.
Yeah.
Just to get enough of this guy's playing live, because I was just trying to figure out what he was doing, you know. But then when I had finally gotten to meet him and he sat down, I was like, no, man, you mute here, you do this. It's a lot of right hand. Just kind of gave me some really good tips. And he was like, just find dudes you dig, listen to Elmore James, and just find guys you dig. And from that point, I found, you know, like, a lot of the Tampa Red was a guy that I loved. Obviously, Robert Johnson, and then I found like Ry Cooter and Sonny Landreth, like the newer guys. But yeah, I just went back to kind of what Warren gave me advice on, and that was it. And it really meant a lot to me, and really helped me in my career.
You ever hear this guy Junior Kimbrough?
No, I don't know him.
Oh, he's awesome. Just kind of like in that genre, that, you know, older sort of black dude who played like in, you know, like illegal juke joints down south. But there's quite a lot of recordings of him. And his album titles are like really, like, they're very negative. But like one of his albums I like is called Most Things Don't Work Out. Like a great title for a blues player, but God damn it. It's a great record, but he's really good too. One of those guys. So Kevin tells you that you're going to, one day he'd have a spot. My question was, that's kind of an unusual thing for a lead singer who's active in a band to tell you, like, hey, there's going to be a spot for you. Was like that guitar chair chaotic or something, or?
No, not as far as I knew. It was really just, it was more of a, we're going to work together at some point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And,
it wasn't specific to Candlebox. We had discussed it, years prior to me playing, where, you know, I think a lot of their, what was going on with Candlebox at the time was up in the air. We wanted to work together. So initially when he had called me for us to work together, he had a side project that he was working on called Le Projet with Morgan Rose from Seven Dust, the drummer from Seven Dust, mm-hmm. Adam Curry, who's our bass player in Candlebox, and our friend Lenny Cerzosi, who's in a band called the Mayan Factor, and he's based in Staten Island. So they had called me to just come in and do a couple sessions for them, and I went in and laid down a couple solos, and it really worked out. And, they've offered me a slot in the band to do this side project, which I was like, yeah, man, it'd be awesome. And me and Morgan were on a string, man. We were
right.
We really worked together well. Just the type of drummer he was, and just really fell in with the rhythm work that he was doing. And he's kind of a multi-talented cat where, you know, he was coming up with some riffs and just fleshing out ideas. And this is only over, you know, a couple sessions that I did for them. And then, I think maybe 3 months later or 4 months later, Kevin called and said the spot in Candlebox was available, and would I like to join up with them. And yeah, I was all for it. I was very familiar with their catalog. That all that music hit when I was a freshman in high school.
Sure.
The whole Seattle Grunge thing, and then what Candlebox's record hit when I was a junior in like 93.
Right.
So, you know, that was all super influential music for us. Like all those guys were on the covers of the magazines back then and getting their songs tablatured and everything. So, you know, I spent a lot of time studying that music at the time.
You sound like a real, it seems in just talking, you're like a really committed student and to like from a work ethic standpoint. Where did that come from, any place in particular, or like, where'd you get that hustle from?
Most likely my grandparents, I would have to say. My grandmother's work ethic was outrageous. She worked up until the time she was 97. She just passed away. Oh, she passed away on New Year's Eve.
Oh, my God. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. 98 years old. She had a wonderful life, but just the hardest worker. She managed, you know, 40 rental properties and ran a hardware store and two contracting crews for my grandfather. He had passed back in the early 90s. And she ran all that, and she just never stopped working. She just stopped working when she couldn't anymore.
You know?
And that was just up until the last 6 months.
Was she from this country? Did she immigrate here from another country?
She was from here, but her parents and everything were from Italy, from outside of Naples.
Wow.
So I'm half Italian and half Irish. I have the most Irish name in the world.
Yeah, you know, Quinn.
My father's Irish.
That's really cool.
You know, I got the work ethic too from both of my parents. They're both very hard workers, and they both worked. My mom worked multiple jobs at one point when I was younger. My father worked in the unions back in the 60s, but he was also a pole lineman for Conrail, a railroad.
Oh, wow.
Collar guy for 35 years. And, you know, just a hard worker. You know, we never wanted for anything. There was always food on the table. Just was lucky enough. I was blessed with wonderful people around me whole life.
Very that's great, life. Man. Very nice. Really cool. I love, you know, in the, maybe it's just the people I'm talking to, the work ethic of the people who become successful in music is impeccable, man. It's second to none. And maybe it's in every business, but I mean, I'm just so blown away every day and inspired by every story. Like, you know, your hustle, you know, and even your open-mindedness, I'm going to do classical, you know, I just wanted to get better at this thing, this guitar thing. You know, I think that's just really admirable, man. Really cool.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. And it, you know, it just came from them, and I never looked at it as, there is so much stuff in the industry that's a pain in the ass. But I never looked at it. I was just doing it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to explain it really. I just did it because I loved it so much. I was passionate about it, and I wanted to be better.
Yeah. Okay. I think that, I mean, I've learned a ton from my own personal growth about the value of having that passion about something you do from talking to all you guys, to be honest. And I've really had some serious conversations with my own children about that over the last 2 years, about how important that is, because I see the warmth about how you approach things. And I think that means a lot. There's a lot more rewarding things than just getting a paycheck, you know, and I've learned that. So I think it's just great.
Yeah.
Hey,
I do spend a lot. I still spend 6-7 hours a day on it too.
Do you really? You still practice?
Oh yeah, all the time. Just looking up stuff on, especially now this day and age, with being able to go on YouTube and see, like, you know, Yngwie doing his thing, or like the shred. I practice a lot of shred stuff, although I don't have much of a it doesn't really serve a practical purpose for me in what I do as far as playing live and that stuff. But I just, you know, just to keep my fingers limber and stuff, just checking out guys that are doing like all the sweep arpeggios and the, you know, quick 3-note per string stuff. I really do enjoy practicing that stuff to kind of keep my mind sharp.
That's
keep,
cool,
keep
man.
My hands warmed up. But, you know, I'm more of a, me and Kevin always joke, I'm more of a street player.
Yeah, you're a blues rock guy, man.
Yeah, blues rock guy. But I really, really dig practicing a lot of the shred stuff at home just to try out different stuff. And then if you do slow a lot of it down, it's you come up with some pretty cool ideas. But sticking around the modes and just being a student of the guitar.
I got Paul Gilbert coming on here soon, and you talk about shredders. I was like, you know, but you know, you ever see his hands? His fingers are like, it's like Vi. I mean, these guys have, like, I'm a short guy, I'm 5'9", you know, these guys are like, I'm just looking at their fingers, it's massive, man, what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy that they, with the left hand, Vi with the legato stuff. And then Paul, he's just the alternate pick manimal, dude. Like, that guy's just so badass. Had his videos, those old REH videos that they came out with on VHS back in the 80s.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And all those, me and my buddy, that's what we would do on weekends, is hang out and watch those videos. Yeah. And then constantly watch, we taped, Guns N' Roses live at the Ritz in 88. So that was a lot of studying going on in that.
That's
well.
Cool, man. Tell me a couple of funny or interesting or cool stories about your time with either Burial Ground, Octane, Foster Child, or Candlebox. Some funny stories if you have any.
Probably the funniest one I had was Foster Child. We're on tour in 2008. And we were sharing a bus with Tantric, the band Tantric, and those guys were a blast to be out with. But we had a show in Grand Rapids, Michigan, And we were opening for Tantric on that tour. And just one particular show, the guy that was my guitar tech at the time forgot to tape down two of the quarter inch cables I didn't have a loom at the time. So
oh my God.
Taping them down. So they were loose on the stage and he hadn't taped them down on my outside. It was on stage left. And they were running back to my amp and I didn't see them, man. And I slipped on one rolled under my boot.
Oh my God.
And I slipped and I caught my balance. And then the other one, when I stepped back, I hit the other one and just fell right on my ass. And that it was at the intersection in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the place was packed. There was thousands of people there, man, just completely wiped out. But I didn't break the headstock on my guitar.
That's what I was thinking. As soon as you said this, I'm like, oh my God, Gibson headstock gone. You're so lucky.
Yeah, I completely lucked out. I was able to hold it off the ground. I took the brunt of the hit. That was like one of the funny stage stories. Yeah. Other than that, man, it's just like getting to hang out and see all of our buddies backstage at a lot of the festivals. You know, we'll just catch up on old times and like that and just have a lot of laughs. We're never at a shortage of laughs, especially with Candlebox, man. Like all of us really enjoy being around one another and being on the bus together. It's constant ball busting, which is great. I grew up in a long line of nut crushers, but, you know, with an Irish dad and two older brothers.
Line of nut crushers. That's great.
There's never a shortage of laughs, just, you know, screwing around with one another and just having a great time. But we do all get along really well. The funny story is just, it's just really day to day, man.
That's really cool because you got to, you know, the hang is what it's all about. You know, you're only on stage for an hour or an hour and a half. You know, you got 22 and a half hours of, you know, good times or misery. If it's up to you guys, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I really do think that the relationship you have with your bandmates, it really does transfer to stage, you know?
Oh, and, God. Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it's just, you know, we have a good, it's visible that we're having a good time on stage. You know, if something goes sideways or, you know, you get your stage goblins up there, like you can only really control your stage volume and your tuning.
Right.
Past that, what's going to happen is going to happen. Yeah. So, you know, I think because we all do get along so well, and it wasn't just with Candlebox, that was across all the bands. We all, I've been lucky enough to be around guys that we've always gotten along. Like there's always little things that'll go on, but I've always been the type of person that if there was any kind of issue, I would be vocal about it and speak to that person directly.
That's great. Yeah. You have to be, man. You can't.
You got to squash it,
man. You can't be passive aggressive and then you got to ride on a bus with somebody for another 3 weeks. It's like,
I was gonna say, man, you're stuck on a rolling tube with these guys. So it's, you got to make the most of it. But luckily I've been blessed to be around a lot of guys that are like-minded. So
that's cool. You know,
just everybody respects each other's space and cleanliness. And me and Kevin are extremely OCD.
Are you guys?
Man. He's always vacuuming the bus. I'm wiping down the bus with Clorox wipes constantly. It's like, you know, we are kind of like clean freaks on the road. So that's kind of humorous. In our the video that we released for Supernova, there's they got footage of Kevin vacuuming the bunk alley the bus. It goes a long way with that, you know. And I like I said, I really do think it transfers the stage with how much we do get along.
That's fantastic, man. That's really good. Are you working on anything now that you're excited about in particular?
Yeah, well, we'll be going back in. Candlebox is going back in the studio in August. The way we made Disappearing in Airports, Kevin came in with a couple skeletons of songs, and then we just kind of fleshed the rest of the album out. We had that record done in 2 weeks.
Hey, that's great. Do you record in a proper studio, an old school studio, or do you go, you have a home studio, one of you that you all put together, or?
The last Candlebox record, we went into Think Loud Studios in York, Pennsylvania, that our friends from the band Live own.
Oh, cool.
And that place we wanted for nothing. It was just completely worked out, state of the art, no stone left unturned. And
that's great.
That facility is beautiful. And they had condos right on site. So, the condos were right on site of the main control room.
Holy shit. So you got to, wow, so you lived right there.
The whole band and crew were right there. That's great, the engineers man. were on call. So it was fantastic. But I that was a big reason, I think, of why we were able to get that record done that fast. But that was a very instinctual and stream of consciousness type record. It was kind of like our On the Road, Jack Kerouac On the Road album, you know. And to be honest, it's one of the records that I can listen to because I'm still finding new stuff in it. Because we had done it so fast and, like I said, done it so stream of conscious that by the time I got a cohesive mix back of it, months and months later, I didn't even really remember what I played. So I had to listen.
So you had to go back and learn your stuff so you can play it.
But learn exactly what I played, but it was such a refreshing way to make a record because then I was able to go back and listen to it. You know, Kevin, we all were very proud of that record and love that record. But yeah, I'm still finding some new stuff in it, and not just my own stuff, just, you know, stuff maybe Adam did and or Cruzan did on the drums, which there's just so much that guy does, little nuanced stuff on the drums. It's killer.
That's so cool, man. So how is this one going to be made? Do you have any idea or?
It's looking like it's going to be the same way.
Oh, that's great.
I'm kind of welcoming it to be that way just because of how well it went last time. Again, Kevin will probably come in with, I know he's working with some outside writers as well this time, come in with some skeletons of songs, and then we'll just do what we do to it.
That's awesome, man.
So certain songs I'll be in more of a session capacity, and other songs we'll just write from scratch, which is always a challenge, but completely up for it because I think that's just, you can't get any more creative than that.
Well, dude, I'm looking forward to that, and I hope lightning strikes twice, and I'll look forward to hearing it, man, and hopefully having you on the show to talk about it.
That'd be great. Thank you.
So you grew up in Wilkes-Barre?
Yes, yeah. A town in between Scranton and Wilkes-Barre called Pittston.
And it sounds like you had a really good childhood.
Yeah, it was a great childhood. My parents, like I said, my parents were very hard workers, very good people, raised by wonderful people on both of their ends. And just my parents are still together, still married 52 years.
Dude, that is so cool. That's so rare, man.
Yeah, how about it, right?
That is so rare. Like my kids, because I was just saying we've been married 25 years, they're like the only they're the only kids that their parents are together, man. It's just really,
yeah,
it's just crazy, man. I feel lucky, you know. We actually like it. I mean, it sounds like you and, you know, Denise the same. I actually like my wife hanging, especially I like her more now the kids are gone, quite frankly.
my wife is my best friend, man.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference in your life, man.
Yeah, of course. Been very, very lucky on that end as well. And you know, like we were talking before, I think we were recording, just when her and I met before all of this and really before any of the music stuff took off. So there was no hidden agendas there. You know, we've been just tight since day one.
Yeah. That's really cool, man. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Do you have any other side hustles going besides guitar, playing guitar for a living on stage?
Yeah, you know, I signed up for this app called Meat Hook. I was telling you earlier about MeetHook, there's a lot of like really well-known cats that have signed up for it, and you could just go on there. They post an available schedule on that app. You have to have the app and put your information in, and if you know they came across me or any other, like drummers or guitar players. I mean, there's oboe players, harp players, PR consultants. It goes across so many genres of the music industry. You could actually just go on there and search for somebody you dig. And if you see they have an available time, you put your credit card in and you get that time with that person one-on-one through a video lesson. So yeah, I'm going to be doing that. I have yet to really get that up and running only because of my touring schedule has been insane. And then if I'm off from Candlebox, I'm still home in the Philly area doing a solo acoustic hustler, this and that. And
sure.
Aside from that, I just golf.
Good for you, man. Are you a good golfer?
I'm just getting back into it after years. I could hit straight.
Do you know, you happen to know a guy named Matthew Lee out of Nashville?
I don't.
He's a great golfer. Matthew Lee and another guy, two guys I interviewed out of Nashville a long time ago, Chuck Ward and Matthew Lee. Right. They golf all the time. Really good golfers. You ever run across those guys?
I'm always looking for a challenge. Again, that's another one of those things. It's like a lot like guitar playing, just repetitive motion, and you only get as good as much as you practice.
Definitely, man. Hey, what were some of the low points, Brian, or maybe darker periods that you've had to deal with through life, and how'd you get through them?
Really just trying to get myself established. Really wasn't I don't ever really think I looked at it as dark points. You know, I did take it certainly wasn't a dark point, but right out of college, you know, I like I said, I had a degree in teaching that I could have went and gotten a job and a career and went straight in, been making, you know, better money than making music at that point. But I went in and I took a job at Tower Records, making minimum wage at that point, just so I could meet label people.
That is a really impressive.
Yeah. So I took that job. I think I was making maybe $200 every 2 weeks at that point, or somewhere around there. But I knew all of the label guys that were signing these new bands that were coming in. Like at the time, I believe Disturbed had just gotten signed, and there was a bunch of killer new bands that were coming out at that point. And I knew just from going in record stores to buying the CDs all the time that the label guys, all the sales guys, would be coming in there to pitch their new bands and see if they could get them into the stores. So I kind of positioned myself there to meet label people. And I did. And that's how I had met my first music attorney, entertainment attorney, was through those sales guys. And then they introduced me to some A&R guys, and it just kept networking and networking, and networking. Yeah. I can't.
Dude, that's really awesome that you did. That's very calculated. And that's commitment, man, that's fucking serious, man.
Yeah. I knew where I wanted to be, man. You know, I'm glad I got the college education and got my teaching degree, but I wanted to be a guitar professional guitar player in any capacity. At the time, you know, you're still in that mindset of, man, you got to sign a record contract, right? Got to sign a record contract, and you build it up in your head as to be this thing. I guess right. That's the dark thing. Like, you build it up to this thing, and then when it finally happened, I'm like, and we went through everything that we dealt with the label stuff. It just kind of worked completely opposite of it. Really, actually, kind of hindered being progressive and productivity at that point. You know what I mean? Where it was just, now we're dealing with all this other bullshit that doesn't even matter at this point. You know what I mean? It really kind of had it took focus off the music. Really.
Yeah.
So I'm just glad we made it through that. I guess I'd say that would have been the darkest point, was actually signing the record contract, because it just didn't, for us at least, it didn't, no good really came of it.
That's too bad. And I have heard that. This is not the first time I've heard this story. You know, and it's always the same thing. Man, I thought signing a record label, getting a record deal is where it's at. Boy, was I wrong. That's exactly what I've heard.
And for some people it was, and God bless them, man.
Yeah.
It did work out for them that way. But it just for me, it wasn't meant to be, which, and I was fine with, because the good that did come out of it was because of the people that I met through that experience, was what led me right to Kevin Martin. So that's was basically how Kevin and I met, and, you know, all those years of networking, working at Tower Records and everything. And I don't mean to say that the Tower Records experience was dark by any stretch, because I met a lot of wonderful people through that as well.
Sure.
But yeah, just getting to that point, it was, you know, a lot of hard work and a lot of networking and just playing all the clubs. And I had formed Octane in that time, so we were playing a lot of clubs. Took a few years before we were making any kind of real money, but I was supporting myself through that. Once I was able to support myself fully on my salary from Octane, was when I was able to kind of get out of working at the record store.
Yeah. Good for you. I really admire your commitment, man. It's really awesome. Very cool. I'm so glad everything worked, but, you know, I really like your attitude about it too, of like, you know, it didn't work, but it got me here. So it did work, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here now. Yeah. And I think that's the way you got to look at things in general. Otherwise you kind of be bitter any other way. I mean, everybody has hardships, you know. It's like you gotta take the good with the bad, I guess.
I don't, it's never gonna go the way you know, you build it up into your head, or the
leaves
way
flash it, yeah,
you know. But, you know, I think really just sticking with it and staying dedicated and having discipline and a passion for something you know, it's no substitute for the hard work.
Yeah, man. I'm really happy for you. Any advice, if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, assuming you would have listened, is there anything you would have wanted to tell yourself that would have made life easier in any way?
I wish I would have, as far as guitar went, I wish I would have listened to my my guitar teacher back then at the time to really, his big thing was don't learn patterns, learn the notes, learn the fretboard, learn, you know, a lot of the more of the theory stuff, as much theory stuff as you can. And, you know, there was a lot of guys that said, well, Eddie Van Halen didn't know any theory. He's Eddie Van Halen.
And I don't know how true that is. You know, it's easy for someone to say that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, that's probably the biggest thing, as far as the guitar playing. It took me a little while longer after that, because when I had gotten into the classical program, I could have been so much further along, with my theoretical knowledge, and I wasn't. And that was kind of there was a pretty hefty learning curve.
If you had known the neck a little better.
Yeah. Just knowing it a little bit more, really everything kind of began and ended for me with the circle of fifths. Once I kind of unlocked that theoretical knowledge, that's when everything kind of opened up for me. And then it was really just putting the time in.
Very cool, man.
Yeah. Business wise, it's just, I guess going back, I wish I hadn't been so obsessed with, you know, having to sign a record deal and do this and do that, because I think my thought process on, especially with Octane then, my thought process on songwriting wouldn't have been like, all right, man, this song got to be 3 minutes and 30 seconds and it got to be a hit because the label's not going to go for that. Like, just create, just be creative and go and create. And I don't care at this point in my life if the song is 6.5 minutes, if that's what I need to get out without meandering, you know what I mean? Without it. But just being creative. I just go back and tell myself to just create. Don't worry about what song's a hit and what's not. That's for the label people to decide anyhow.
Yeah. Very cool, man. That's really good advice. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. You showed me some of your very cool guitars there. What's your go-to guitar right now?
My number one is an 89 Les Paul Standard Cherry Sunburst. That was my very first Les Paul.
Really?
And I got it when I was 15. My aunt that had, she passed away from a very rare form of leukemia. I was very close with her. It was my mother's sister. And she bought that for me on my birthday. And that's been my number one. Not only.
What a great gift, man.
It was so cool of her to do that. And she was a hairdresser. And, you know, I know she saved up, and it was a lot of hard work for her to get that guitar for me. But she knew how much it meant to me to have a Les Paul, because I was just such a, Randy Rhodes and Slash and Zakk Wylde and Warren Haynes.
I was going to say, that's Warren's guitar, the Cherry Sunburst.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So I was just so, and Dwayne Allman, I was just, and Billy Duffy. I mean, I could just go on and on and on with the guy, John Sykes. I could just go on and on with the guys that were Les Paul players that I just idolized, you know? So, finally getting a real deal Les Paul was just such a big deal for me. So she bought that, and that's been my number one. And, on top of it, the sentimental value of it, it sounds so good, man. Like I hate leaving it home, but sometimes I have to.
That's great, man. Really good story. It's funny you mentioned John Sykes. I connected with him recently. I need to follow up with him. This show has been so weird. I've been really open. I've opened myself up to listening to the environment, and everything has worked.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, I've opened myself up really to that. And by doing it, everything has worked. So I hooked up with John a while ago. Now you just mentioned his name. So now I got to make sure I call him and I book him on the show, because we had spoke. It's just really weird how all this shit has happened.
Like, how so? Like, what environment do you mean? Like the West Paul environment or the...
No, just opening up. Oh, no. You mean like opening up? Just to listening to people. Being much more open to listening to the messages the universe is sending me. And they usually send them through other people.
Yeah.
Right? Or through situations. So I hooked up with John a while ago, and we kind of talked briefly. Then he hit... you know, he friended me on Facebook and I've been meaning to call him. And now that you mentioned him, I said, okay, now, okay, that's my final message. I've got to call. Because it's like John Sykes is not a guy people mention very often.
No, and he's such a monster player. Oh, my God.
Right.
The slide it in stuff and that self-titled, when I heard that riff and the tone that he had for Still the Night, I was like, man, this dude is just outrageous. And it was a Les Paul and a Marshall, as far as I knew. I think it was that Marshall that he travels with, I believe. But man, his tone on that record, both those records, his tone anytime, even with Blue, and then when he had Blue Murder, that was just completely sick. Yeah, we're just talented, talented guy.
So now I got to call him, man. Thank you for
that's great, man.
Well, that's why someone had mentioned Denise had mentioned me, and I don't know why it skipped over my head. And then when Kevin, I said, man, I know that name, and I said, I got to get him on the show. It's just really, I'm like very trying to like be, and everything is kind of, you know, I shouldn't say this to put this out there. I mean, things have run smoothly.
Yeah.
Because of that, you know, so it's been, you know, I'm always like, I want to make sure I don't stop listening is, you know, so I just made a note. Okay. John Sykes, boom. So thank you. So number one is your 89 Les Paul Standard Cherry. What's two and three?
Two and three, probably, I have a 97, I believe it's 97. Yeah. 97 Black Classic. That was that first year that they came out with those, ceramic pickups in it, so that thing's a flamethrower, man. That's a pretty hot guitar.
That's with the 500 and the 498T, I think.
Yes,
yeah.
I have that sitting here. They made there was a friend of mine that was working at Gibson, and I believe that they made a run of these for Mick Ralphs when they did that Bad Company reunion. And I picked this up out in Westchester. I think it was one of the 15 that they had.
Oh, that's cool.
Done for him, yeah, which I didn't know at the time. And then just going back and kind of researching the guitar, I found that out. So
it's just a Les Paul Classic, but it's black.
Yeah, I actually have that one right here. My
dude, let me see it.
I haven't unpacked from tour yet.
Very cool. Man, that's really clean.
Yeah, man, it got some burns on it, but I got some, there's some wear out of my, They did a, it's, I don't know if you said it, a limited edition.
Yeah. I see a little decal.
This one, my red sunburst.
Beautiful guitar, man, really pretty.
Thank you. Yeah, my red sunburst is upstairs. I still haven't unpacked for tour. I just got home yesterday.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I haven't unpacked it yet.
And what's number three?
Number three would be probably my, I don't know. I love my Flying V. But
do you play that a lot? On,
I can't really travel with it. We do so many fly dates that I can't really travel with it.
Yeah, there's
no case for it. I'm hoping mono creators. I use those mono cases to fly all the time. I'm hoping that they'll come out with something for a V or something wide enough that would fit the V, because I certainly would take it. That thing's a rock machine. But my other one, I'd say my number three, which, and I've never been a big custom guy. I love all Gibsons, and I really did want a custom. That's a 1990 custom that I picked up about 10 years ago. I was being very patient in finding. I wanted an Alpine White custom that yellowed over, because I wanted one like Randy Rhoads is my guy. He's my number one as far as you know the hard rock and metal stuff. So I wanted a Les Paul that was yellowed out like his, and I waited and waited and waited, and this one kind of found me.
Where'd you find it?
Oddly enough, it was a guy up in not far outside Philadelphia, up in I think he was in like Royersford or Collegeville, Pennsylvania, not far outside Philly, and he had a private collection, and I found it online and went up there and checked it out, and the price was really reasonable, and I got it. So that one is a 1990, and it's a custom. Like I said, I'm just so used to rosewood fretboards that, you know, the ebony board feels a little heavy to me, but I did want a custom of my collection. It didn't end up being my number three. And the weirdest thing was I had switched out the rhythm pickup in there to another Gibson. Was it the 498, I guess, is the rhythm.
Yeah, that's the one in the Classic.
Yeah, so I switched it out to one of those, and when we took out the pickup, my mother's name is stamped in that guitar. So who, I don't know, whoever was maybe, you know, did the, like the quality control at Gibson or whatever, but her name was Barbara. And when we lifted that pickup out to change it, my mom's name was stamped inside of it.
Wow. That had to give you a little goosebumps. That's kind of weird.
Kind of odd, you know? So, yeah.
Well, dude, you were meant to have that guitar. That's for sure.
Yeah. Like I said, it found me like all.
Yeah.
All I normally do, you know?
That's really cool. So you like a hotter pickups. You usually play hotter pickups.
Yeah. You know, I just, my big thing with pickups is, if it sounds good, man, I just like everything stock. I really won't change anything out. I wasn't crazy about the pickup that was in that custom, which is why I changed out. I like that really deep, warm, like really bassy, low MIDI tone out of, cause I use that pickup a lot for soloing. I have an MXR, just a microamp boost.
Mm-hmm.
I just hit that when I'm soloing, and, cause I don't use any distortion. I'm pretty simple when it comes to the guitars and the amps, man. I just want a stock guitar that sounds great, that has good pickups in it, that doesn't necessarily need to be hot, but just sound good. And then as far as I've used pretty much all Marshalls.
What are you playing out of now primarily?
Because we rent backline so much on the touring, I usually just use Marshall JCM, high gain dual reverb, the 900s.
Mm-hmm.
Just for, because of what the gig calls for, excuse me, for what the Candlebox gigs call for, you know? So I use two of those. I use two Hastacks as my dirty sound. And then I use a Roland JC120, the jazz chorus, for my clean.
Okay. So,
and I switch between the clean and dirty with an Ernie Ball pan pedal, because it drives, I can't stand like the pop of a hard switch from a clean to a dirty channel.
Yeah.
So that Ernie Ball volume pan gives me that option where all the way back is clean, all the way forward is the two heavy half stacks. I run them in tandem, and then, but anything in between will mix.
Oh, that's, you know, so great.
I mix some of the clean amp with the heavy amp, and I could go one way or the other, one side or the other.
So you have certain where, you know, at this angle, this is the sound you're going to get. You know, at this angle. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's really cool.
A song like Sometimes, off the Happy Pills record, I have it pitched equally right in the middle between the clean and the dirty. And then I still kind of old school it, where I work my volume control on the guitar, where if I want a little snottier, I go up further. If I want to keep it a bluesier, you know, between 5 and 7, and then if I wanted a little cleaner, I roll back. I think it drives my front of house guy nuts a little bit, but it's just how I control it. I'm kind of always looking for a tone. I'm always adjusting on the fly during a live gig with my volume, just where I need to be.
You know what? The guy who adjusts the most that I've ever seen, I haven't had him on the show yet, is Derek Trucks. I've never seen anybody adjust constantly tone involved. I mean, constantly. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I've seen him adjust quite a bit. I noticed that Warren adjusts quite a bit as well. I've never seen Warren really adjusting for tone, but I do see him adjusting for volume. And for as many times as I've seen him play, I mean, I was telling you earlier, just dozens and dozens of times with Allman Brothers and Government Mule, his adjustments, I mean, you could hear it. You know what I mean? It makes sense. The guy is just so,
he's
just so dialed into where his tone is and where he needs to be at every split second. It's amazing. I love watching that guy play.
But it goes back to what you said earlier. You said, you know, about golfing. You said, hey, it's like guitar. You got to just get out there. Who's plays more than that guy?
Yeah, I mean, really.
He's playing 300 nights a year, probably. Maybe more.
Maybe more than that. Again, the work ethic guy, and coming up and, you know, following guys like that and really studying players like that. You're not only studying their playing style, you're studying how much these guys work.
Yeah.
You know, because he's always on the road. You know, and there's a lot of bands that are doing that, you know, whether or not they're playing guitar or whatever, just a lot of guys that I kind of have a lot of respect for, just because they stay out and they're just dedicated to the craft.
Speaking of that, who anybody who influences your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
Probably my biggest influences that people would be surprised to hear be like Clarence White from the Byrds.
Oh, wow.
Who's I was showing you that black Les Paul back there.
Oh, that's the B-Bender. That's why you I've never heard anybody have a Les Paul with a B. Like, do you play in country with that? What do you – I mean, like
– Yeah, I'll do sessions with it. I mean, the majority of the sessions that I do are kind of B-Bender and like slide guitar. I do play a lot of slide guitar, so – outside of Candlebox, you know, like the session work and any of the, you know, pickup gigs I do with my buddies from, you know, local gigs around the area, just anything to keep the guitar making noise, whether it's acoustic or electric, I play a ton of slide. But yeah, that I got that Les Paul B-Bender back in the day, just kind of ran, again, it found me in a music store in Northeast Philly, and I saw the price on it. I was like, yep, I'm getting it. So I was initially looking for a Telecaster that had the Parsons White B-Bender on And that particular one has the Parsons White B-Bender on it, but that's a custom build. All of the guts are inside that guitar.
Very cool.
Which was pretty interesting because normally you see the big
plate
on the back, on the back of the guitars. And oddly enough, two nights ago, I was on a gig with Audley Freed in Nashville, and he had a Tele body. He had a different neck on it, but it was a Tele body, and he flipped it over, and he had all the guts of that B-Bender built into the guitar, but he had plexiglass over it, which I guess really took care of the weight. And he showed me how it was working, and it looked like a different, just kind of a different mechanism, but it was a Parsons White mechanism, and oddly enough, Gene Parsons installed it for him.
I was just going to ask if Joe Glazer did that, because that sounds like something Joe Glazer would do out of Nashville.
Yeah, he said Gene Parsons himself.
Oh wow!
Installed that, and when he turned it over, there was Gene Parsons' signature on it. So, I guess back to the original question. Clarence White from the Byrds, it was a huge influence for me. Roy Buchanan is another guy that was a massive influence for me. Like that guy's tone and. Just his feel and just the odd bends and just being so creative with it, just like kind of
such a soulful player, man.
And just like, I mean, really just using that guitar as a vehicle for channeling.
You know?
And that guy was just the no choices and the tone and just where he would and the phrasing always, he just always blew me away.
Yeah.
And then, going back, like way back, I mean, Tampa Red is probably my guy for glass. I played closed top, glass slide, the Coruscant bottle. And obviously, I'm big Dwayne
Allman. Yeah.
So I was prior to Candlebox, I was playing guitar for Greg Allman's oldest son, Michael.
And we did
a whole Allman Brothers tribute thing. So I got to play all Uncle Dwayne's slide parts, which I was in my glory doing that.
Is he down here? And I'm in Tampa. Isn't he near here?
Yeah, I believe he is.
Like Port Richey or something?
Yeah, I think he is.
Or Newport Richey or something?
Did, his dad and uncle, they were up from the East Coast, I believe, right? East Coast of Florida? Michael, Michael is out near Tampa because he came to see us in Tampa.
Yeah.
I think he is out that way.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yes, I played guitar for him for a little while, and I was just... Like I said, man, I was in my glory getting to play, all Uncle Dwayne stuff.
That's really cool, man. Very cool. What's the best amp and best guitar you've ever owned or played?
Best amp or guitar? I played a JCM 800 at a gig. It was a backline rental where the hell were we? It was at Jurgle's Rhythm Grill in Warrendale, Pennsylvania, out near Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
This backline company came in and they had like,
dude, your memory is like really sharp, dude.
Yeah.
That was impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not saying the name of that Jurgle's, three times a week, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. No, well, I remember it's a great place and they have a great staff there, but I remember it mostly because of this amp. This backline company brought in, it was a cloth front JCM 800, and they brought it in, and it was on my side of the stage, and it had like I don't know if it was faded or if it was like a more of like a silvery like cloth that they had where the big Marshall logo is. Mm-hmm. And I plugged that guitar in. I had that and me a 900 running, but I usually test them one by one. So when I hit the standby on that JCM 800, I hit one A chord and I turned around and I was like, I will buy this amp from you right now. I heard one chord out of it. So that was one of the best amps I've ever played out of. I have a JCM 800 sitting right here, which is like an early 80s. It's a four input that, my friend Paul Hammond, who's the guitar player for Get the Let Out for the Zeppelin tribute. They don't really call them a Zeppelin tribute.
There's so many Zeppelin tribute bands. It's like, I mean, and you know what? I've talked to a couple of them and they said that, do you know John Wiedemeyer by any chance? He's out of Vegas.
I don't know.
Guitar player. He's in one and he was telling me that he said it's really hard to get booked because it's the weird thing. Like if, let's say your buddy's band plays a certain club, they're loyal to that Zeppelin tribute band. They won't book any other Zeppelin tribute bands in there. So he said, because we've been trying to get to the East Coast and nobody will book us because they got, you know, your buddy's band or whoever.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, their niche, their whole niche is that they recreate the live or the studio records.
Okay.
So they don't do like the live performances. They don't, they're not doing like any impersonations or anything. And there's six or seven of them in the act. And they're, you know, doing all the guitar parts and they have all period correct gear,
which well, that's is
pretty,
wild.
Pretty outrageous.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
But outside of Paul doing that, he's a brilliant electrician, basically, I would call him, because he works on all the electronics and just has his knowledge of that. It's like I always joke with him, call him Rain Man, because he's so good with that. So building all of his own amps and everything. So he modded that. The particular Marshall that I have now and gave it to me for my birthday about 15 years ago. That's a great amp.
Dude, you must be a very good person because everybody gives you like really nice gifts. So you got to be putting out some good energy, man. No, yeah. These are really like very personal gifts that people are giving you. And that, and you know, some of them are costly. And of course the one from your wife is different, but that's really, you know, you must be putting out some good vibes.
Well, he's always been very good to me. Paul's a very close friend of mine. We're neighbors, actually. He lives just a couple blocks away. So, yeah, we do spend a lot of time together. And, he's always been very good to me. And he knows I was in it for the long haul, that I'm a lifer. So he was like, yeah, man, you got to check this amp out. And, in fact, I'm going up to a friend's place later today to Paul texted me yesterday. He said there's an early 80s Silver Jubilee original to 2550. Said it's as clean as the day is long. So I'm going up there today and hopefully going to be coming home with it.
Good for you, man. Congratulations. I hope you do.
Yeah, me too. That's another, I'm very patient as far as waiting for amps and guitars. I kind of wait for them to just rear their head and find the right one.
Yeah.
So I don't jump the gun and just buy something to like do an impulse buy.
Yeah. But yeah.
If it's the right guitar, the right amp, and it's there and it finds me, I'm going to pick it up.
Well, you're in traffic, so something's going to find you at some point. Yeah. You know, might as well get the one you like. Anybody can buy anything, you know?
Yeah, and that gig we did in Nashville a couple nights ago with Damon Johnson with his band.
Oh, you play with Damon? I had him on here.
Yeah. We just did a gig with him in Nashville the other night. And
have they gotten that thing sorted out? If you know, they had he had a whole problem with like Pledge or something.
So that's what this was for. This was a fundraiser for him.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you know, we went down there. It's like, nope, don't want a penny for it. So we flew there. We had a gig this past weekend on Saturday. We played with Tesla out in Iowa. So we flew on Sunday morning right down to Nashville to do this thing for Damon.
Oh, that's really nice.
And it was fantastic. And he brought out, as luck would have it, the exact amp that I'm going to look at. You know, not the exact one, but the exact model. And they don't rear their heads
that's
too
cool.
often.
He's got a lot of equipment.
Yeah, a lot of great equipment too. So he brought out a bunch of stuff, was, you know, gracious enough to let us use all of his gear and trust us with it. So that's what we did. We just went in and used everybody else's gear. Oddly, and myself, I use, like you said, I do those channel switch or the switching between the clean and dirty. So Oddly and I used an older DeVille. So I used that for my clean, and Oddly just, as he would, smoke that thing.
He's such a good player, man.
Oh, God. And then I used that Marshall Silver Jubilee for my dirty tones on that gig. But yeah, it was killer. So it just turned out that this exact model turned up at my buddy's place. So I'm going to go go take a peek at that today.
Fingers crossed, man.
Yes.
How about guitar? What's the best guitar you ever played?
I got to play an original 58 Les Paul at Songbirds Museum in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And if you ever get that way, I would recommend stopping in that place. It's guitar heaven.
Songbirds Museum.
Yeah, Songbirds Guitar Museum in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Is it an actual museum or is it a store just called Guitar Museum?
No, it's a museum. I mean, nothing's really for sale there. A couple guys own it. I know they basically combined their guitar collections. I think Vince Gill put a lot of his guitars in there to see. I mean, they have Dwayne's original Firebird that he used on the Aretha Franklin sessions.
Oh, that's great.
Russell Scholes. I mean, he got some rare stuff in there. But he had an original 58 Paul that he let me – he took me into the vault and let me check it out. And I got to play a couple notes on it. And I mean, that was just, that's my guitar. Like even more so than a 59, the 58, the original Gibson 58 is the one you'd go.
Do you know Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
He's got a 58 that he takes with him.
Yeah. God. Yeah. I don't know if I travel with them. I don't know if I travel with
him. I know. he doesn't take it out with him all the time. He'll take it out once in a while. He's got a Gibson made years ago. This is go on a rant for a minute. This is a guy, all he plays is Gibsons. And Gibson made a limited edition Greg Martin guitar. And then they stopped making it. And they need to give that guy some light because he's a Gibson lifer. That's all he plays. He's a great blues guy, you know? Yeah. So anyway, and he's a great person. So that's why I'm on a bit of a rant.
My buddy Paul Hammond, who we're just talking about, that
the electrician guy.
Yeah. He gave me he gave me like a permanent loaner on a 58 VOS custom shop, Paul. So I have that upstairs that never leaves the house. That's like, when I'm sitting and having coffee in the morning, I have a little Black Star, like one of those little cube amps.
Yeah.
Sitting on my coffee table. And while I'm sitting watching the news in the morning, I'm warming up, playing that.
With that custom.
Time. Yeah.
Good for you, man.
That custom shop, man, it's beautiful. That's a 58 VOS Cherry Sunburst, which I love.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
Desert Island Discs, top three. No particular order, just your knee-jerk reaction just for this moment.
Desert Island, definitely Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction.
Do you remember when that came out? Like, it came out at midnight?
Yeah, I got it the day it came out.
Yeah, I did too. I went down to the record store, yeah.
I wore out probably three cassettes of that record.
No. The thing that came out at midnight was Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah. Right. I remember getting Appetite. Yeah. Like, 87, like the summer of 87. That was it for me.
Great record, man.
I heard that guy playing guitar. I was like, whoa. Yeah, who's this dude? him and Izzy, actually, they're both outstanding, huge influences for me. Another Desert Island one. It'd have to be something by Bob Dylan. Probably, I guess off the top of my head, maybe Blood on the Tracks or Highway 61.
Highway 61, so great, man.
Yeah, I mean, it just... something by him. And then I'm trying to skip around a little bit here too, because I'd love to have something there by the band, but I don't know if I could live without Blizzard of Oz either.
I thought you were gonna say it's like I'm waiting for Randy.
I need Blizzard of Oz there. I mean, it's so hard with just picking three,
of course,
so much stuff that I love.
Oh yeah,
but Appetite, definitely. It's something Bob Dylan, probably either, yeah, the band, or definitely Blizzard.
Very cool, man. Hey, what's, Brian, most important things that you've learned about yourself throughout your life experience?
Probably just, being respectful and treating people how you want to be treated was my biggest thing. And then just putting my head down and getting the work done is probably been the biggest thing. I really don't, it's nothing I really have ever stopped to think about. Like I said, I just do. I just kind of keep looking forward and keep working towards being a better player and being a better bandmate and being a better husband and son and, you know, all of the above, man. I just want to be a good person and you know, I'm just, and be prepared, I guess, really. I've found that, you know, preparation meets opportunity. So then just, yeah, that's it.
You said so many good things. You said, I just want to be a good person. Keep looking forward, doing to others. Just put your head down and work. All good stuff, man. Thank you. Real cool. This tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
I'd say the work ethic at that point, if I had to choose one thing, and that, I'm extremely loyal, to any of my friends, anybody that needs anything, I'm always there for them, and I'll, you know, do anything I can, shirt off my back for them. You know, if they need help, I'm there to help.
Are you a Scorpio?
No, I'm not actually. I'm a Virgo. I think that kind of explains a lot of the OCD.
Why Virgos? What is Virgo? I don't know. What are Virgos thing?
I guess just very, opinionated and very focused in and kind of perfectionist.
Okay.
I don't know if we're recording when we're discussing the OCD, but like I was telling you how well us and the Kevin would.
Yeah, you guys, you and Kevin are like, yeah.
Well, we get along so well, but me and Kevin are total clean freaks. Our bus is immaculate. It's so funny. After every run that we do, every driver is like, hey, if you guys need a driver, clean up after ourselves, you know, like all they're doing is driving. The bus is immaculate. You know, it's like I wake up every morning, wipe it down with the Clorox wipes.
That is really funny, man.
Like a total germaphobe and OCD, I guess, is kind of a downfall.
What do you do as a performer? Because everybody's like, yo, and shaking your hand and stuff. Do you like, what do you do? Give them the fist or what do you do?
No, I don't mind that. Like, I'll shake hands and everything. I just always make sure I wash my hands. I've seen guys wear gloves. I haven't gotten that far.
Right.
But at least, like, not in the summer or spring. But yeah, no, I just...
because some guys are like won't shake your hand, and they're like,
oh yeah,
you know,
I'm not that bad.
Yeah,
I'm bad, but I'm not that bad, or yeah. I guess good if you're
if you're OCD and clean for
OCD and germaphobe wording of it, but now it's I never mind that. I love meeting as many fans as possible and as many like fellow musicians. Like just the way I was saying, that Nashville gig the other night, man, just blew me away. That was the first time I got to spend some minutes with Brad Whitford and Audley Freed, and ran into a couple guys that I had met before, but we really, really didn't know each other. Now we had, you know, kind of traded information. I got to chat with Frank Hannon a bit.
That's cool.
Who was a big influence for me. Tesla was a big fan for me back in back when Mechanical Resonance came out and the Great Radio Controversy. You know, that was
good albums.
Oh my God, they were wonderful. And it just a great blues player, just picked up a lot of stuff from his playing back then too. It's, you know, it's funny to think about. You go back, there's like your influences that you have that are, I mean, really you either wear on your sleeve or that are right in the front of your mind. And then, you know, hearing Frank live and seeing Tesla live, that was the fourth time I've gotten to open for him. I forget how much of an influence that guy had on me and those records had on me, especially with the songwriting end of it as well.
That's cool, man. Yeah, it's funny because like my wife's a little OCD and I'm the opposite. Like I will put my hands anywhere. I don't really give a shit. And she's like, you know, she'll just call me over sometimes if dirty work has to be done. And she goes, how do you do that? I said, look, I peed in a New York City subway station. Like nothing's going to fuck me up worse than that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it back in the day when they had toilets in the subway. So I'm like immune forever because of that. Yeah. I think, you know,
No, I don't mind getting dirty. I'm still a guy's guy. I don't mind getting dirty on that end. But just as far as the keeping stuff clean is where me and Kevin are always OCD about it, you know?
Hey man, whatever floats your boat, whatever fucking makes you happy. It's not like you're hurting anybody in the process. So what the hell, you know, do your thing, man.
Yeah.
Happiest moment in your life.
Oh gosh. Getting married. I don't mean to hesitate. Getting married.
You didn't hesitate.
Yeah, I did marry my best friend. So
that's very cool.
Yeah, that was pretty monumental for me.
You're getting some props when she listens to this.
Yeah, right. Yeah, She's like, "Oh, you had to say that." No, I really didn't. But that really was. That was sure. Monumental for me and very happy, kind of a culmination of all the years that we're together and all the hard work that we've done together. Because as you know, she owns a PR company and represents a lot of bands, and she's worked very hard, and her work ethic is very hard.
And when two people own a business, it is tough.
Yeah.
And you're both entrepreneurs. It is not an easy thing by a long shot. Because, you know, entrepreneurs, you have good years, bad years, and you still got to do your thing, man.
Yeah. I mean, we make a good team, and that's the only way I'd like to work. You know what I mean? And
very cool.
She supports me 100% on my endeavor, and I support her as well on hers.
That's great.
So, yeah. And then I guess career-wise, man, I don't know if I could really pinpoint one thing, because then I'd be kind of discounting a lot of others. I mean, just to be able to what I do professionally and make a living at it, it'd be probably my biggest achievement and what I'm happiest about, you know.
That's great.
Just, even if I wasn't doing it with a national band, you know, I've kind of found the way as I've gotten older, measuring success was just making a living at being a professional musician. You know what I mean? No matter what you're doing, it had nothing to do with the record contract or albums or the, you know, a national band that sold this many records. I do love where I'm at for sure. And I'm very thankful and blessed for the opportunity and appreciative of it. But yeah, I mean, I think I'd just measure the success by you're making a living doing what you dig. You know what I mean? And not just playing guitar. Anything that you do, you know, I'm like, my wife loves being a PR agent and writing copy and doing tour press, and that's what she loves to do and very be creative. Cool. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Well, it's cool, man. You've worked super hard for it. You deserve it. Besides golf, any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Movies. I love watching movies. Just following shows, nothing in particular, just like watching actors be great at their craft. Any artist that's good at their craft, you know, I just enjoy seeing creative people be creative and excel at what they do.
Very cool. Talk about a specific experience that changed your life or changed the way you think about things.
The music business.
Bravo, yeah, man.
Yeah, the music business. You know, sports is a big hobby of mine. I watch a lot of sports. I'm big into athletics other than golf, but you know, NFL football, Major League Baseball, hockey.
And you come from when you grow up in a city, that's kind of hard. You know, growing up near Philly, it's kind of hard not to.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and where I was in growing up in Pittston, we were.
Oh, were you closer to Pittsburgh?
Well, no. We were close to New York City. So it was like we're 90 minutes from Manhattan and 90 minutes from Philly. So
you're a Jets fan or a Giants fan? Or?
No, I'm an Eagles fan for sure.
Through Sorry, man.
Yeah. All right. I was happy we got the one, man. So we'll see what happens. We got a good team happening. But, I really did. I was a big Yankees fan when I was growing up as a kid. I followed the Yankees in American League and the Phillies in the National League, and then always followed the Eagles in the NFC. And then just oddly enough, I was a huge John Elway fan when I was a kid, so I followed Denver in the AFC.
Sure. That's cool. So,
which was kind of odd. That was just the oddball pairing.
Hey, man, I'm a Raiders fan. I grew up in the Bronx. Go figure. So it happens, you know?
You're a Raiders fan?
Yeah.
You broke out. You said the Raiders.
Yeah, I was a Raiders, and I grew up in the Bronx. So go figure that.
Oh, geez, you're telling me sorry.
Yeah.
You're a Raiders fan?
Oh, I know. It's abysmal. It's jeez. Like, hey, and the Knicks. So between the two of them, I'm like a zero with sports, man. Trust me, it's been a very, very, very long run. Anything you wish you did differently?
No. Except for the fact, like, if I had to do something different. I guess I wouldn't do it different only because I met my wife at college, but I was really, really, I had my heart set on going to Berklee, College of Music, when I graduated high school. And, you know, my parents were just kind of bugged out about that, you know, just going straight up, like right into a school to basically just training you for rock and roll, you know? So, but, certainly not a regret. I kind of wish I did went there and maybe even did a summer course, you know,
yeah.
did something, because I just think that that level of education that you're getting, as far as, you know, being able to do, be a hard rock guitar player or whatever, for that, that genre of what I was into, I think would have been, would have put my playing far, far ahead of where it was at the time.
But, you know, just to let you know, everybody I've spoken to, Berklee, it was only jazz programs there.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah,
there's no, there was, it was, you studied jazz guitar there, period. Like, I know some guys that didn't go to Berklee, because, and you not know Duke Levine?
I don't know.
He's a guitar player out of Connecticut, real good player. And he went to something called like Boston Conservatory, which is right down the road, because he did not want to study jazz.
Right.
And I don't think he still studied rock, but he didn't want to only be tied to jazz. And at Berklee, that was the curriculum back in the day. I don't know. Maybe now it's different. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe it is. But I mean, that's the only thing that I could think of from back then that I was kind of, you know, we had that mindset of, well, I guess sign a record deal, or, you know, really want Berklee. But yeah, as far now, as far as doing any of that, as far, and career wise, especially now, man, I think it's all worked out the way it was supposed to work out, to be honest with you. Like I said, just kept my head down, keep doing the work.
That's awesome. Two more questions, man. Toughest decision you've ever had to make, or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Tough decision, I guess, was up and leaving my Octane. When I left Octane, that was a really rough decision for me. I didn't really want to split from those guys. I was making fantastic money. Would always factor into it, you know, when you got to keep food on your table.
Yeah.
I was making really good money with those guys, and I thought we were about to hit a stride, but it was just one of those things. I don't think we were all on the same page of where we wanted to go professionally. And I just, that was a really tough decision that weighed tough on me. I didn't want to do it. I kind of had to do it.
Sure.
You know, professionally, personally, I don't know. Hardest decision I had to make personally. I guess there's just been a bunch of them. I guess maybe going into music full time was probably the hardest decision to make, because it's not the most lucrative profession in the world, as people know. You know, if it was easy, everybody'd be doing it, right?
Oh God, yeah, not the truth.
The one thing that I think people see is they always see the finished product of the stage show.
Oh yeah, they don't know the sleepless nights in a van and lugging shit and fixing cars and broken fucking fan belts and all that stuff.
Exactly, man. Yeah, underneath tying up one of the ones that was like the scariest ever is pulled over on the side of 95 just at, like, in North Carolina. Me and our front of house guy, when I was with Foster Child, under the van, propping up the entire exhaust system, and I'm like wire tying it with hangers. Traffic's going by 100 miles.
That is a scary road, too. 95 is so damn dangerous.
You know, I didn't even tell my parents that story, just because my mother was like, oh my God. But you know, just seeing the end result of that stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that was a tough decision, was just foregoing a very stable career to go into one that's completely unstable, not very lucrative at times. And, you know, it requires 100% of your attention and dedication. It's just, there was no way to halfway it. And I'm glad I recognized that early, and I'm glad I went through what I went through to get there, you know. But there's no half-ass in it, for sure.
Well, you're a smart guy too, so that helped you. You know, your awareness of what's going on, I'm sure, made the decision a lot. You know, made your ability to overcome all that stuff easier. So, not easy, but, you know, your ability was there, so, which is great.
Yeah, just keep looking forward.
Last question. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I think I've become a lot more patient with things, like, to instead of being so I'm still bullheaded, but just so like on edge about everything, where I let a lot of things just roll off my back and be like, you know what, man, I don't even have time for it. Just trying to just keeping toxic people and attitudes and things out and just letting stuff roll, where before I'd be like, I wanted to rip somebody's head off. And I'm just like, I don't even have time for that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to let that fall by the wayside and let that person be who they are and get them as far away from my affairs as possible.
Yeah, man, when you let stressful stuff go, your life is so much like easier to manage and less stressful when it, you know, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's about it. Just patient and just, yeah, I don't know. I guess that's what I would say, man, just being, and more, you know, a lot of times too, I had, when I was younger, had a hard time letting go of shit as far as like what had happened, like being really, yeah, you know,
a bit hanging on to stuff,
just hanging on to stuff, like the shit that happened with the labels or, you know, any, you know, passed up with bands. You know, I had a hard time letting go of it. And then I was just like, you know what? I just got to really just keep moving forward. If you dwell on that, you're not living in today and not looking.
Yeah. You can't look in the rearview mirror. It never serves you.
Yeah. But I'm glad I got out from under that probably in, you know, my late 20s, which was, I guess, pretty early for somebody to get out from under that.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. Well, good for you, man. Congratulations. Listen, man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate it. You're a super cool guy. Please come back when the new Candlebox comes out. We can talk about it and promote it. And let me tell people where to find you. So sign up to Brian's website. He's got an email list. It's at Brian Quinn Guitar. And Quinn is, of course, Q-U-I-N-N. So go to brianquinnguitar.com and sign up to Brian's email list. Also, you can hit him up and engage with him on social media. On Facebook and on Twitter, it's Brian Quinn GTR. And on Instagram, it's Brian Quinn Guitar. And he's got a YouTube channel. Is that Brian Quinn Guitar as well?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So hit him up on all his social media and subscribe to his YouTube channel. Subscribe to his email list at Brian Quinn Guitar. Also, check him out on Meethook, MeetHook.com. And you could engage with him there and take a lesson from him or just you know, have him show you his guitars for an hour on Skype if that's what you like. Who the hell knows, right? It's anything. Like your time, they're renting your time for whatever you want.
Yeah. So I have stuff set aside for lessons. There's stuff set aside for like songwriting consults.
Oh, that's great.
Your console, like anything like that. Whatever they want to talk about.
Very cool.
It'll be in the description of the time frames that are on the app as well. Like it'll be a half hour. I do the guitar lessons in 30-minute intervals. And
very cool.
Whatever else they wanted to chat about. Yeah. And I appreciate your time and having me on.
Thanks, man. No, it was my pleasure.
Yeah, just getting to chat, man. It was really good talking about all that stuff. I don't get to do it too often.
Oh, cool, man. I'm happy. And thank you. And check out Candlebox. We'll be doing a new album release fall or winter.
Yeah. We're going in August to record it. So yeah, probably early 2020.
Early 2020. Great. We'll look forward to that. And thank you for everything. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
Everybody, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on your social media channels and subscribe to the podcast. We appreciate your support. Thanks so much to Brian Quinn for spending time with us. Again, please support Brian's music with Candlebox on tour. If you go to Candle, I'm assuming candlebox.com, the touring schedule is there?
Candleboxrocks.com.
Great.
It's on there. The schedule's on my website as well.
Great.
Yeah, we got the European tour coming up too. So
you guys coming down here, or you'd probably just here, I would imagine.
We were there not long ago, but next time we get down there, we got to get together.
That'd be cool, man. Yeah. Go to a guitar shop and I could watch you buy some more gear. There's a great guitar shop down here, actually.
One more drool over it and wish I could afford it, right? we usually do Janus Landing down there.
Yeah, that's a really cool. You know what, man? I used to see Mule down there, but the last two times they came, they like totally oversold it. I couldn't breathe there, man. You know, you come down here in August, it's like fucking brutal as it is, you know, outdoors. It was so crowded, man. I went once with my son and we left after the first set, and once with my wife, and my wife was like totally besides herself. She was like throwing me a bone coming with me. And she's like, I got to go. I'm like, no problem. I got to go too. So, but that's a great venue. I love that venue. I saw Robin Trower there a couple of times. Oh, great show.
Yeah, man. Monster player as well.
And thanks and support Brian's music. Go to his website at brianquinnguitar.com and sign up to his email list, and all his socials are on there. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com, sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out.
Peace.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.